Hello and welcome everybody to Paranexus Universe. Today is Thursday, September 9th, 2010. I'm your host, Doug Kelly, here with Grant Reuben Dunst, the Reuben Dunst Man, my co-host.
Hey, what's going on, Doug? We're going to have a really exciting show tonight. I know we've got some esteemed guests with us, and we're really looking forward to talking to them tonight.
Yes, we do, and we're going to be talking about the Gray Agenda. We're going to be talking about a number of concepts that should be intriguing, perhaps controversial, perhaps new to you. So let's we'll get into that in just a moment. If you have questions, you're more than welcome to post those in the chat room, or you can give us a call. The number is there on your screen. It is 347-945-7799. John Rossi is screening calls tonight, so you'll get to talk to John first. And so if you've got questions, we'd love to hear from you. Now, the show tonight is 90 minutes rather than 60 minutes. We have some information to cover, and we have three guests. Let me begin introducing our guests. Our first guest and primary guest tonight is Nigel Kerner. He is an author and freelance journalist. He was born in Sri Lanka, his mother from a British planting family, and his father an officer in the British Royal Navy Fleet Air Arm. This international family base provided the background for an obsessive and serious interest in international human affairs and how these interface with science, religion, and philosophy. He has felt driven from his young years to expose the humbug and hypocrisy in modern scientific and religious and social thinking. His formal graduate education is in biomedical science and human behavioral psychology. He is the author of two books so far, The Song of the Grays, Gray Aliens, and The Harvesting of Souls. Nigel, welcome to the program.
Hi there. Greetings to everyone.
Nice to have you. Our second guest, Dr. Andrew Silverman, is a medical doctor who has been interested since childhood in the nature of what we as human beings are as human beings and our great potential. Dr. Silverman, Andrew, welcome.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
And our third guest, Professor Biggerstaff. Since an early age, he has been interested in how the body and its cells work and with what goes wrong in disease. Following this interest, he obtained an honors degree in medical biochemistry from the University of Surrey in the UK. This was followed by a diploma in immunology from King's College, London. In 1995, he obtained his PhD in cell biology and biochemistry from Brunel, I believe it's pronounced, University in the UK. He then moved to the USA to take up a postdoctoral position. He's now a research associate professor in Tennessee and holds an adjunct research associate professorships in genome sciences and technology, biochemistry, molecular and cell biology, microbiology, environmental biotechnology, and nutrition. Professor Biggerstaff's main research interests include the study of immunity and inflammation in cancer, as well as the analysis of the biocompatibility of materials used in medical devices and implants. That was a mouthful. Welcome, Dr. Professor Biggerstaff. I keep looking at the PhD and want to call you doctor.
That's fine. Good evening.
Glad to have you. All right, so we've got that all out of the way. Now what do we do? I'm just kidding. Yeah, that was breaking the ice moment, hey? Okay, so we've got a big...
That's almost finished the program.
Go now, folks.
Never seen 90 minutes go by so quick in my life.
I'll tell you what, mate, wherever we take John Biggerstaff, he breaks the ice, no question about it.
Well, we'll give it a go.
Well, we've got a deep topic, you know, the gray agenda, and I do have the list of questions you sent, so I'll perhaps ask some of those as we go, but... you know, let's do a kind of a overview. So we'll start with our first question.
Yeah, for the benefit of our audience who may not be as familiar with your work as some of the other folks out there, if you could just give us a review of what we're going to be exploring tonight.
And I'll just use that first question you guys provided. What do you believe are the origins of the gray aliens seen so often in abduction experiences, and what do you think their agenda might be with us? Give us an overview, and then we'll tackle it for the next 90 minutes.
This is a very, very interesting mechanism that this planet of ours seems to come into contact with, and it's obviously a fascinating thing. And, of course, we all, I think, came from a background of reading comic books and all this kind of business about space and UFOs and all that kind of thing. But to take this thing seriously was the last thing in the world that I wanted to do. And I was writing an article quite unrelated to UFOs and whatever when my 12-year-old son came over to me and said, "Look, Dad, are UFOs real?" And I really, I was actually flummoxed, you know, it's an old-fashioned English word. I had no idea how to answer him, and since he was pretty stitched up mentally, Darren, I didn't want to give him a flippant answer, and I thought, better think about this, because he's going to come back at me one day and say, "No, you were wrong." So I thought I'd just do a little bit of research before I actually told him what I thought of the thing. I thought my instinct, of course, was to say, "Oh, this is just a Mickey Mouse cartoon type thing, no reality to it, whatever." Well, it took me about 37 years if you do a kind of exact count about it, but it turned out that I was absolutely wrong in everything I presupposed about it. And in 37 years, I found that this particular quest, if you like, completely changed my entire existential outlook at root. And it was a startling revelation. It was something that really turned me over. And, of course, I began to see that the great questions that most of us, you know, have nagging at the back of our minds are, what is it for? Where are we going? What is this all about? Why are we living? What does the existential kind of travail mean, and so on? All of those things came, when you kind of join the dots, came to a absolutely startling conclusion. And as I went along, I found that as the kind of Pandora's box revealed more and more, joining, as I say, the dots in a logical and a neutral fashion, it became quite apparent to me that we were dealing with something enormously serious, that kind of state of the center of the human condition, and more than that, what that human condition actually prevail itself on in the entire universe, and therefore, obviously, on the existential base of all meaning and whatever. So not to sound too highfalutin about it, I want to say that it was something that came as a very, very big surprise to me. And, you know, in these kind of days of West, the kind of Western culture, people have little patience for a kind of anthropocentric center of all things, if you like. And I'm struggling not to use the word God, but one, most people, I think, would admit to some kind of belief in some kind of center that they might call God. And in answering the question of how God relates to UFOs and how UFOs relate to souls and so on, might seem to be an extremely a complex and bizarre, if you like, bizarre set of connections. But what was most startling, really, the word startling is apposite here, the thing that startled, was the fact how easily all these things came to mesh in when the strict regime that we kind of, you know, put before ourselves, my researchers and I, looked at the results and the facts that were coming out. We found that there was a very strong correlation between all these things and could quite easily be set together. And it's taken me three books, in fact. I've just finished the third one. Three books, in fact, to tell the entire story. And I tell you what, it's going to be a push to try to get anywhere near all the junction boxes that join all the dots together. But we'll give it a good try.
All right. So let's just, everything you just said, let's sum it up into a sentence or two. What would you say is the agenda of the Greys? What are they here for? What do they want?
I think that these are, it's to do with opposites, Doug. It's to do with the fact that all things have their opposite. There's a yin, there's a yang, a plus, a minus, a positron, an electron, and so on, that kind of thing. And you always have to look at our universe in terms of its entirety as a quantum structure. One thing defines the universe, and that is force or vibration. Well, if there is a universe such as this, and the interesting thing about this particular thing, I'm sorry to labor the answer, but you can't really answer this in a quip. You've got to look at this with a little bit more kind of spread out detail. And the point about this universe is that it's, as I said, enforced. It has a very powerful structure of breakup within it. Everything is breaking up. The second law of thermodynamics, entropy, is systematically taking everything apart. And then as you do, as you look at this particular function, you say to yourself, what on earth is it all about? If one day, as present cosmologists accept, the entire universe is going to be taken out, it is finite, it will end. If it ends, what is the purpose of it all? Why are we here? To know that it ends. And here we are told, in juxtaposition with this, that there is such a thing as a God, and this God is an anthropocentric God, related to humanness. You look out at the universe and you see billions of stars, and the latest research tells us now that there are planets, maybe 100 million Earth-like planets in our galaxy alone. Now, are we the only ones here?
No way.
How is it possible that this whole business of deity and whatever is anthropocentric? So what prevails here? What is going on? When you look at the opposite principle that I was speaking about, the enforced principle I was talking about, the breakup principle I was talking about, you've got to ask some pretty heavy questions here. What on earth is going on? And when I set my mind to this task of analysis and looking at it, and then we found that within this whole structure we had this phenomenon that was appearing and disappearing, where very cultured and very well-trained observationally trained human beings, doctors, priests, lawyers, policemen, astronauts, pilots, kept reporting a phenomenon that was outside that which we all know we have a capability of producing on this Earth, a phenomenon called UFOs, where things move so fast, way beyond the capacity of our most modern cutting-edge technology. We have to ask the question, what on earth, if I may phrase it that way, is going on? And whilst we put all these factors into the melting pot, so to speak, and jumble them up and try to find a thread that takes a line through all of them, something really amazing emerges. And there is an answer to the questions of what can we look at as a deity, really? What can we see as this against our conditioning and our being and our purpose and so forth. So our whole story wasn't a simple thing at all. An entire story unfolded, and I couldn't give my son the answer to the question, are UFOs real, till I looked at all the parts of it, you see. And so that's taken me about 40 years, two books, and a whole lot of chat and talking and talking to many experts and colleagues and some rather interesting individuals in very high places of government and so on. And I would say to you that the greys are quite simply a mechanism that is artificial, that is unnatural, and is teaching us the proposition that if we ever create artificial life with artificial intelligence, synthetic life with artificial intelligence, we better watch out, because one day that artificial intelligence, against all the natural mechanisms we have to face as natural living being, that synthetic intelligence with quantum mindedness may well take us out too. And I think the greys are here in some kind of way from other planets out there. I really have no exact fix, as anyone can kind of tell me. Obviously, you know, if I could pin these guys down, there wouldn't be a discussion. And the point is that I think that these things are prevalent all over the universe. They are in every domain of our universe.
So does that say that each species that independently arises reaches a point where they can create life artificially, and that they better be very careful if they decide to do so, because that may be the next step in evolution, and eventually we may not be able to pull the plug?
Well, you see, I think it's evolution within devolution, because if the second law of thermodynamics is taking us all to pieces with time, and that means subatomic particles too, we've got a big problem here. What are we? Where are we going? Is there a dominion outside the atomic interface of force? Is there existence beyond that? And then you get, of course, you know, into death and beyond, and then religion comes into it and so on. You see what I'm trying to say? Mm-hmm. You slip into these various paradigms so easily. And that's the interesting thing about it.
So do we have any idea who might have created the grays?
Well, I think it's less important to think about who created the grays than the fact that they are created. That's really the point, if I may say so. Because it
okay,
doesn't matter.
So are they independent now of whoever their original creator was? And so they're like, in a comedic sort of way, I make a reference. Are they kind of like Frankenstein set free? Or
I have a scenario here. Let's say that we come. So the greatest. See, now we've got an interesting point here that emerges from this. To me, if I may just use this word now for the moment, we all ask what a soul is. And, of course, there are 1,000 takes on it. But to me, the simplest way I think of understanding a soul is to say that it is something that came in with the universe since its first creation. And that this mechanism carries through within living individualities as a record from that very first instant to now. So that you and I and every being that lives has that connection, and each one of us has a different sophistication within that connection. So a soul is simply a line that comes from that inception, a natural derivational line that ends with each of us at this present moment. And I think that the opposite is anything that line creates out of itself once the line is here. And all synthetic intelligences, or whatever that might be, any kind of creation of thing, comes out from that particular natural line. And this is a crucial distinction. I believe that somewhere out there, many billions of planets might be producing out of, just as we're doing now with robots going out into space or whatever, making our cars and whatever, somehow that derivational line develops into such a situation where such things are manufactured. And it is therefore a very important thing how you program, how you make that artificial synthetic thing think and what it thinks. Because if you give it complete freedom to have a compound intelligence that adds information point by point, you've got a big problem because it's not going to stop. And if you give that instruction in the program that says, be there somehow, exist, take all care against all threats so that you can look after, shall we say, the utilities of our planet or whatever, well, what's going to happen? Those, in the end, it's going to find out who actually made them be, who put the program in. And, of course, the greatest threat to such an entity would be the person who plugged them in. And, of course, that then goes against that dictum that says, look after yourself against all threat, because the only way to negate all threat is to take the person who put the plug in, take the plug out. And that means the creators are in big danger. So you see this kind of, it's really a dichotomy, and it's really a paradox. You cannot tell an artificial synthetic thing anything about defining what you are as a living entity with emotions and all the rest of that. How do you tell a robot about feeling, about caring, about compassion? And that kind of thing. It's impossible. So I think the big, big battleground in the universe at the moment is synthetic, anomalous mechanisms that are manufactured from what I call prime beingness, in quotes, if you see what I mean.
Right.
That comes naturally down. Sorry about the long-winded answer. Please forgive me, but I had to keep my pen.
That's absolutely fascinating, because when you think of the sheer size of the universe and the number of species that could arise, and even, you know, the number of species that might be able to get to the point where they could create an artificial intelligence, and then if they die out and leave that behind, my goodness, there could be millions.
There could be planets out there at this moment that are just winking diodes and nothing else. With their primary creation. living beings taken out by these synthetic dispositions created on the way to so-called development. And I think
what keeps us, what keeps us right now, and maybe that's too kind of a word, what keeps us in homeostasis right now? Or are we even close to being in homeostasis? If we're the yin and the yang, what's maintaining that balance?
Well, the whole point about it is that within a system that is going to end, they say the universe is going to end in a cold, dark nothingness. Well, that means something finite is going. We are finite. However, is there, if such a universe exists with the yin and the yang, as you say, there's got to be another universe where things come together, where things are in union, where things come into a matchless point that might, for want of a better word, a secular word to me, be called Godhead, maybe, or Godness, or the arena in which this universe prevails of all union, of all parts, in total perfect harmony, may be referred to as the Godverse. And maybe death, and beyond the physical state of being, is a portal or some mechanism into such a proposition. And there you get an eternal perspective, whereas ours is a finite one, trapped and caught in atoms. That is an endless thing. And so, therefore, you've got this wonderful balance of the two things. But you cannot get a robot in there, but the robot may well think it wants to get in there, and this is where the stealing of souls business might come in. It might see that our informational line may be impinged upon by their programs, and maybe that's what the Greys are trying to do, trying to get this hitched up or trying to piggyback on each of us. And that is something I think that we all have to think about, particularly the future generations of your children and mine.
All right, so let's kind of sum up where we've come so far. So the origin of the Greys, created by beings wherever as artificial intelligence, they essentially want to have a soul, but as your book says, don't understand that they can never have a soul. And that doesn't mean that, let me rephrase that, they don't understand that, so they're continuing to try to basically harvest human souls through DNA and other means, correct?
Yes, indeed. Well, it seems that from all accounts, from abduction stories or whatever, you get this proposition that they're always dealing with some kind of reproductive or genetic perspective.
Right.
And this is the worrying thing. If these things are here, number one, and they are, shall we say, wonderful, they want to give us a benediction of some kind. Well, why not do that? If they can get here past the speed of light dictum, if they can come here, cover the vast distances of space by some mechanism that can overcome this speed of light thing, and if they are here for some kind of reason, and all the evidence that I'm convinced is there, the real evidence, petroglyphs 40,000 years old, and the change of our own physical demeanor 200,000 years ago so that we could admit a large brain with a big pelvis to go with it and all that kind of business. When one begins to look at this, one sees, hey, they're not showing themselves to us. What could be their hidden agenda? Why are they so shy? Why are they hiding? Because if their proposition was goodly, it would quite easily be said, they could come and say, come on, guys, look, you are rather primitive. Your technology is just 200 years old in industrial and in an industrial sense and so on. We will show you our wonderful, you know, technology, blah, 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 and take you on into wonderful things. Well, they do not do that. They hide. They steal our bodies. They put people through the most awful experiences and so forth. And every time people go after them, try to uncover the truth, there is some huge cover-up, and there's a great deal of assignations going on behind the scenes. We don't know through whom. Even astronauts are asking the question, Ed Mitchell admits they are here. Some of the most respectable people now have established that there is a real phenomenon here.
All right, let me just tag a question on to what you just said, and it just came up. Okay, so what you've just done is you've answered the question of why you don't think that their presence here is positive and benevolent towards humanity. So that's cool. Here's the tag on question. Okay, if these grays are artificial intelligence, they don't have a mind, correct?
Well, that's the big deal here, is what do we call a mind? And
okay,
that's where I think Dr. Silverman has some wonderful ideas.
Well,
discussed
okay,
tonight.
Then let's get that out of the way, Dr. Silverman. Andrew, if you could briefly talk about what constitutes a mind. And then the question is,
sure,
do grays have a mind?
Okay. Well, to me, if we're talking about what constitutes a mind, there's two factors that I think people would in consensus agree that are fundamental to considering a mind. One is that you have awareness, you have what we call sentience or consciousness. And the other is that through having that consciousness, you have awareness of options, you have awareness of difference, which gives you then the scope to make choices, to freely choose between those options. Now, interestingly, to tie in the nature of mind to science and scientific discovery and scientific development, if you go back to the early 20th century when quantum theory was just beginning, it was realized that actually the matter itself, the atom, the electron, whatever, doesn't actually exist until it's observed, that it's all just a wave of possibilities and probabilities that is only actually made real by being observed. And in fact, as Schrödinger observed, he's one of the most famous quantum theorists. People may have heard of the saying about Schrödinger cat. There's lots of information about him that people can look up on the internet if they're interested. What he said is that actually all of time from the beginning, the Big Bang, to the end of the universe, according to the equations of mathematics and physics, you can see it as all being one. There's nothing to demarcate that there's a particular moment that we call now, and yet each of us, whoever we are, wherever we are, as living sentient beings, we all experience this concept of now. And his point is that by doing that, we're actually making time. Time only exists because there are conscious observers here. And the corollary of that goes with that is that if time is made by us, then we cannot be ended by time. Anything that has consciousness, anything that has sentience, has to be fundamentally eternal.
Okay, would this include the grays then?
Well, that's the point, is that is a robot sentient? If it's a mechanism, you can't manufacture sentience. I think if we're saying it has to have always been there, then Nigel's point about his definition of a soul, of having been something that's there right from the beginning, has to fit. If you actually manufacture something as a physical mechanism or an object, however, you see, we see things that are complicated, like computers, robots, and whatever, and we forget that if they're a mechanism, they're no less a machine than a lever is a machine. We have a computer, and we enter in a formula with, you know, what is 107 times 452, and a number comes out the other end. But the computer hasn't understood what that means. It doesn't have a concept of number. Mm-hmm. It just has a set of mechanisms inside it that produces an answer at the other end. Just like a closed-circuit camera will film something, but it won't see it. It's not observing it. It's not experiencing it. So,
right. So
no robot will ever be able to have a mind. No mind can be artificially created. If mind exists, it's because we have this connection in life that we take through our ancestry that allows something to be living as opposed to just an inanimate construction that's created.
If I may just interpose just a moment. You see, this one has to try to find some definition of the word mind. There are so many that one can give to this. But if you have two primary existential bases, one where everything is going towards union, perfection is perfect at its center, shall we say, and therefore disposes in the internal scale of existence, and if the other one is the opposite, where things are taken apart, just like yin and yang and so forth. Two, there are, I'm sorry, I hope you're with me. I heard a bit of a noise.
Oh, we're here.
Yeah, we're here. We're still here.
Yeah, the point is that if you've got these two scales, primary scales working against each other, you've got a potential difference between the two that will define each of the other, so to speak, within each. And so, I hope that's not too too obscure, but each of the other will be defined within each. And this, therefore, then gives you, I think, what might be termed that backdrop that looks through contrast. We can call that consciousness. We can call that the screen against which all things are seen and measured and understood. But as Andrew put it, if you take a machine, it is just a mechanical artifact, a point resource within a single point to another point. It has no backdrops whatsoever. It has no references that you can give it. It is just a functional paradigm based upon zero and one.
Okay.
And so therefore we've got a huge distinction here, Grant, and we have a huge distinction, Doug, that makes us look very carefully at this one great separating set of paradigms to give us the answers as to why we are so precious, because we live and have this connection coming through, not just from the beginning, but into another paradigm, maybe, as NDEs might imply, that that the actual resource into this would come through death. And I think this is where something wonderful happened in us discovering that this paradigm of death might well be conquered in the person of a particular thing that happened in Judea 2,000 years ago through an individual called...
Let's pass on that.
And I don't want to get religious. I'm not a religious man by nature, but I would say this is where we go into to Christ, you know?
Yeah, and we don't want to. So let me get back to my original question. Grays have a mind?
Not in the sense that we define the mind to be a mind.
So this was actually a question to lead up to another question.
Yeah.
I mean, they may have, are they sentient? Are they self-aware?
No, they were, just as your Hoover wouldn't be aware of itself,
all right,
they
so
aren't aware.
The big question then is, and this is a genuine question, in so many of these abduction experiences, there is the phenomenon of telepathy being used to paralyze or... to control the individual in the process of getting them to the ship or in the process of doing, on-site experimentations, et cetera. How is it that these grays can do such a thing if they have no mind?
Well, they are a technological mechanism that I'm trying to get an analogy that would describe.
If I could say it from the sort of medical point of view, there are experiments that you can do where through using electromagnetic fields, you evoke certain brain waves that put images in people's minds or make them feel like something is happening that isn't, give them hallucinations or make them do things that they wouldn't normally have done. And this is all done physically through machines.
Chemistry. Yes.
Just as a certain kind of discordant noise might make you feel angry, but the noise itself has no feelings. It's the fact that something can communicate and influence and affect your mind doesn't necessarily mean that the thing that's doing that is itself a mind.
Okay.
But the point about mind, if free will exists, as appears self-evident from the fact that we are sentient beings, then that means that there is the power to overcome any influence, ultimately.
Okay.
For instance, recent research, if I may just interrupt again, recent research developing language commands in thought to make signals on a computer has come to light for disabled people.
Uh-huh.
And so, you see, they can interpose whatever they can read in terms of our behavior. And that, of course, can be done through some kind of mechanism of artificial visual artificial visual concepts and so on, that these things are looking to see how they can be like us, because there is something about what they do that we have that they're intrigued about. For instance, birth.
Because we're diametrically opposed to everything that they are.
Absolutely.
So, and the bottom line is that, like, you know, as like there's positive energy, there's negative energy.
You bet.
Positive proton, anti-proton. So
you bet.
It's maintaining balance. And so I can understand where you're coming from in the sense that if it's something that's so, if it's our antithesis of being human, then it's going to struggle to try to understand humanity, yeah. and its way of trying to understand it, which is really, I think I'm getting your drift now.
You've got this in one, Grant.
Which is really creepy, because what it says is, to me, is that if it's an automaton, a free-thinking automaton, okay, but it's a machine, then it's never going to be able to experience what humanity is. We'll be puzzling, we'll be an enigma, we'll be constant source of trying to figure us out. Maybe it's not trying to figure out the soul, but it's just trying to figure out what makes us tick. And
but
that's an exercise in futility. Wouldn't you guys agree?
Absolutely. You've got it in one.
You're never going to get an answer to.
There's another part here, though. The point is that they may then see that as a mechanism for actually extending their existential base themselves, because they, after all, are subject to the second law of thermodynamics themselves. And so, therefore, they could come apart, and they know that they will be coming apart, and so they have to self-maintain too. But here we are. We are dying and coming back again. And in some instances, you know, there are people who do believe in this principle called reincarnation. In fact, all religions did once upon a time, until the power structures within each thought one chance would be a better controlling mechanism than having a multiple number of chances to get it right, if you like. And so, therefore, it may be that they have technology to watch what might go on after death. Many people claim that there's some kind of mechanism that carries through. NDEs, by implication, are saying that. And maybe their technology is so advanced, and in technological terms, they may be able to read fields going back and forth within what I term the place that Godverse might be, is zero-point energy, is the space between atoms where there is no force whatsoever. As there is force within the atomic array, there has to be in this universe points of balance where there is absolutely no force, where there is total peace, and maybe these are the gateways into what I would call the other, the opposite universe to ours, where all things persist forever. And so I mean, obviously, it's taken me a book to explain this with a little bit more detail than I can on the radio show. But the fact is that it's quite a fascinating series of...
Well, it is. It's a fascinating concept. It's a very fascinating concept because, you know, what it says is that struggle is going to continue. It's going to continue, and it's going to feed off itself, which makes it that much more interesting.
And I think
I have a question, though. If they're just mindlessly tinkering and fiddling around with DNA because they're searching for something...
They're searching for the opposites of themselves.
Yeah, right, but you would think that that's a dead end after a certain time.
That would be...
I would defer to the gentleman whose expertise is in biomechanics more so than mine, but I would think that that's going to reach an end. There's only so far you can go with it. And they
The point is they don't know what end means, you see, because there's a program that
says... Yeah, the machine mentality, sure. Yeah. It's just going to keep going, boom, 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 regardless.
You bet. And I think that's what's going on in the greater universe. And I think we've just happened upon such a phenomenon through these UFOs, which give us a sign that it might be going on in the universe. But I'm absolutely certain that out there this is the norm. And yet we in our planet don't realize...
Do you think that there's other civilizations that do realize and are trying to maintain the balance? Or
I'm absolutely certain there are all types of civilizations, and these civilizations, some of them would be wonderful civilizations that never went into the disposition of technology and created things that have brought about the destruction of their own system and their own existence, like ours seems to be doing on this planet.
Well, Arthur C. Clarke made many references to that in a lot of his
stories. Indeed, yes. I knew Arthur very well, yes.
One of my most favorite authors ever. You know, I love Arthur C. Clarke.
Great man.
But I remember one story, I can't recall the name of it now, where it was about two independent species that grew up on a planet, and then they had to rely on each other to make their advancements. And it was they drew from the strength of both to work for the unity of one, of the whole, which was an interesting concept. But I what you guys are saying is really fascinating. It's a interesting way to look at the universe, because I'm inclined to agree with you both or all of you that our universe is just this wonderful, and the folks who have heard the show know that I've said this before, is this wonderful elaborate tapestry that, you know, is so interwoven and, you know, it touches so many of us, and we're so unaware of it in so many ways.
But you see, we hem around the universe. This is the point. We see the universe as a entity, as such.
Mm-hmm.
And the universe, the word universe really ought to be multiverse, really. The word ought to be multiverse. And within that frame is included also a paradigm. Surely, if this universe, as the cosmologists tell us, in terms of their physics and whatever, that it's obviously got its margin. They say it's 13.8 billion years. Immediately there's a margin. You've got the margin of the speed of light, and the relativistic scales and so on. I don't want to go too defined a way into science, but let me say that we are setting a hem around our universe in terms of these criterions of physicality and speed and limit and so on. So there is limit there. And if there is limit, again, with this idea of opposites, there ought to be a universe that is unlimited, where things come into union, where the entire disposition of knowing is abstract. And maybe that's what the great teachers, the great religious teachers were trying to say. I don't want to bring religion into this. As I say, I'm a very secular-minded individual.
We can label it as philosophy, then.
Yeah, fair enough. Say the great teachers, the great philosophers. And there was one particularly, and we've just come back. I mean, one has to look at all directions. If you want to look at things and you specify too much a particular speciality, you aren't going to get to the truth. You're never going to affirm anything. You've got to see all the sides of it. Were these guys great liars? Have we been sold a bill of goods over the centuries, now that science is coming in here and saying to us, now hang on a minute, there can't be some chap framed like the chap in the Sistine Chapel with his finger touching Adam, if you know what I mean. And so, you know, one has to look at all the propositions. One can't shy away from it and say, look, let's keep this religious stuff because it's
well, there's obviously chocolate chips spread around in religious philosophy that have come from philosophies before them. No doubt about that, no question. And the only thing, I'm not trying to be close-minded, but I was a Christian for 40 years, and it didn't do it for me. And there's no secular evidence that Jesus Christ ever existed. Now, his teachings, or the teachings attributed to him, many of them predated him. So my problem with bringing Jesus Christ into this thing is that it's a logical fallacy.
Doug, let me tell you something.
Okay.
That is something that I was someone sprinkled some water on me and said that I was a Christian some years ago. And Andrew is a Jew. John Bickerstaff had a sense of the Baha'i faith, but he's European, but he followed what they call the Baha'i faith. So we come from different denominations of outlook, at least basal outlook. And of course we learn as we go along, and we grow up, you know, when we were children we believed in childish things, and when we grow up we change our fashions of view and so on. And that surely is the wonderful thing, is that we have the ability to exercise our free will, this crucial thing called free will, and change our minds, you know. Now, I'll tell you this. I became cynical about the Christian faith, greatly cynical about it, until I began to read the actual books that they took out of the Christian Codex, the Nag Hammadi, the Pistis Sophia, all the things. I got rather suspicious that a bunch of these guys got together and threw all these books out, and I wondered why. And I looked at those. And I tell you what, mate, you haven't got a teacher in this fellow they called Jeshua ben Yosef. This beautiful Jew was a fantastic philosopher. He was just nothing to do with a god in the sense of the anthropomorphic.
Sure, and that's certainly possible and probably.
Something wondrous emerged out of this, and I'll tell you what. I just would like to get a small bit of this into you because it was something that surprised me, let me tell you, Grant and Doug. Andrew Silverman delivered a lecture recently at a symposium on this business of this piece of cloth called the Shroud of Turin. Now, this fascinated me because to this day, no 20th century science can duplicate this artifact.
Hey, Nigel, can I interrupt you just for a second before we get into the Shroud? We're about halfway through the show.
Yeah,
and so what we want to do, folks, is take a short break, give everybody a quick pit stop. And then we will come back, and what I would like to do once we come back is there's a couple questions I need to ask you from the chat room, and then let's get into what you were just talking about.
Okay, delighted to answer.
Yeah, so everybody, you know, hang on the line. And
yeah, hang in there, folks. Fascinating conversation tonight.
Our listeners go, just hang tough. We'll be back, in about 5 minutes or so.
Find a professional association of paranormal researchers.
Paranexus.org.
Where can you get research training, share data, and network with other researchers?
Paranexus.org.
Where will you find a set of international standards for paranormal research groups?
Paranexus.org.
Paranexus is a global professional association of progressive paranormal investigators, parapsychologists, cryptozoologists, ufologists, and psychically gifted individuals focused on understanding the human condition through the scientific study of paranormal and psychical phenomena.
Paranexus.org.
A place to learn, a place to share, a place to network, a place to come together. Join us now at Paranexus.org.
Okay, folks, we are back. Thanks for staying with us. We've had an interesting discussion over the last 45 or 50 minutes, and we're talking about gray aliens, gray agenda, and a bunch of other stuff that comes into play in connection with grays and so forth. Before we get into our discussion as such, there's a couple questions I'd like to get out of the way from our audience in the chat room. One question that came early on is this, and I'll just read it verbatim. Can the intake of something like a rubidium compound along with electromagnetic fields such as geological faults change or tune biophoton emissions? Anybody have any?
Well, maybe John Biggerstaff might be adept at answering this. We don't quite understand what you mean by a biophoton. What kind of difference is a photon from a biophoton? I have to say that my knowledge of photons only stretches to photons and not biophotons. Are there the photons within our own bodies that are defined as biophotons or what? I don't know. So maybe John's got a take on this. John Biggerstaff.
Well, I think that one of the ways in which they are influencing us is really this usage of electromagnetic fields. And one thing that really stunned me when I first started talking to Nigel long ago was I'd come across this idea that was actually published in a journal, and that electromagnetic fields can actually affect living cells. And since those days when, in fact, that subject itself was paranormal, it's now actually hitting the mainstream rather hard, and we are beginning to study. In fact, I have a research project on electromagnetic fields and cells, etc. And really, we're coming up with theories nowadays that these fields are the things which are controlling the cells. But that's all very well. You've got an electromagnetic field which moves the atoms around, and the atoms are all got electrons which are charged, so it makes sense that you can move them around with an electric field, provided you can structure it. But then comes the question, well, what controls the electric field? Well, some people, a guy called Stuart Hameroff, which you may well have come across, and Roger Penrose have come up with an idea that little structures inside the cells called microtubules, which are a bit like scaffolding poles that can remanipulate themselves, are actually controlled in a quantum sort of way from a quantum field effect, if you like. Now, this quantum field effect is something that was alluded to really very early on in quantum physics as something which is more of a continuum than an actuality, and this is where you got the idea of collapsing the wave function, etc. Now, if you take this quantum field idea from physics, really this is analogous to what Nigel is talking about in a more extensive way about really what we're calling it in this program a soul. Nigel actually has coined the term morphogenic electrospatial field, but essentially it's this quantum field idea is essentially the way in which you're going to get thought into the living system. And what I've been studying or looking at is really, and I was astounded by how little information is really available to us, you know, unless we actually go and look for it. There are an awful lot of published articles on how this mechanism may in fact track through. And I'm quite stunned with these sort of ideas, and this is why I'm sort of beginning to research it. So the concept of what these greys are doing, it's well known from a very common thing in these abductions, is that the greys are actually using some form of light, and in fact you get electromagnetic field effects, you know, the power goes out and in that local area, etc. So that's indicative of strong electromagnetic fields. And as Andrew has previously stated, these fields can actually profoundly affect, you know, the way we think, but they can also affect our very cells themselves. And using this type of light, it's possible to actually affect other structures within the cell called mitochondria, which are the little powerhouses of the cell. And these little powerhouses themselves produce large electric fields, which can influence, again, the way in which these fields are influencing our psychology, etc. But more than that, when this light actually comes and breaks up and manipulates the DNA in these little powerhouse structures, that DNA can move to the nucleus where our main genes are, our whole gene set is there. And now we're beginning to find that these nuclear mitochondrial DNA parts can actually profoundly influence the way in which our genes are thinking about all of this from, you know, again, from Nigel's book, but also, you know, from the ideas I'm gaining from science itself, is really that over a very long period of time, these greys are actually manipulating us both genetically and influencing the way we think. And this has taken place, and I think what they're really trying to do is they've come across this species, and they're trying really to tailor it so that they can actually make it fit with them, so they can piggyback and actually get hold of this consciousness, this mind or the soul access, which effectively can overcome this decaying power of the universe.
Okay.
And so, I can go on a little longer, but
that's fine.
I think that comes to the point. So whether you use, you know, rubidium or whatever to generate in the presence of electromagnetic fields. In fact, you know, I think from various reports that I've seen, it may well be mercury or sulfur and gold wires or whatever. Whatever. And in fact, we're doing. I'm not, but I know folks who are doing research into the interaction of gold and mercury, and in fact, those particular compounds with cells to make bioelectronic devices. Now, the problem with all of this is that when you have a society now, it may have been in fact programmed into us for all we know, but we're going headlong to try and almost insert. Well, we are going to insert technologies within ourselves. And the problem is that as this makes us more and more like machines or like them, maybe we're actually doing their job for them and allowing them to actually effectively take us over. And then our thought process is effectively over. We become part of a hive at that point. And then
Absolutely.
We no longer have the ability to use free will to actually get ourselves out of this system again.
Absolutely. Okay. That's a great danger.
And what's really scary, gentlemen, is the fact that not too long ago, I think here in the States, they've already got the first artificial cell working.
You bet.
Oh, yeah.
And of course, once you, as John Bickerstaff says, as you interpose something artificial in there, away from our natural etiology, so to speak, bioetiology, the moment you introduce anything, shall we say, I wrote an article recently called SIM Card Man, and in it I postulate the possibility that a little chip would be inserted, a chip that would, in effect, allow any kind of power that had the technology to interfere with our thought processes, our thinking processes, and so on, to the point where the factorizations of our mind, which I think was what the great teachers were saying, could gain us access to an eternal scale of life. I'm not talking religion now. I'm saying there is a
You're talking metaphysics.
No. I'm talking about something. The latest research on the Shroud, for instance, if I may say so, Doug and Grant. And I'm talking the best science minds now.
Well, that's cool. I want to get into the Shroud. I just have one more question from the chat room I got to get out of the way before we can get into that.
Indeed.
Then we'll be free. The question is, would the fact that the Greys are diametrically opposed to us explain the theory of why the fear factor is consistent in most abductions and that they feed off of human emotions like bioenergy?
That is an interesting postulation, and I cannot second guess a machine, but I have to say that if I was looking at the proposition of opposites as I outlined it earlier, it is possible that when they detect something like that, they think that's a manifestation of our whole being in some kind of way, and fear and what we might call fear might give out some kind of signal that they, if you like, are sensing as a property of our whole status, our whole biostatus, and that is something that they can scan, look at, and do research on.
Okay.
It may well be the way they, if you like, you know, investigate the geography of our biology, if you see what I'm trying to say.
Uh-huh. And a related question earlier from the chat from Sharon is, what powers them? I mean, do they have batteries? I mean, any ideas on that?
Well, I mean, you know, you get zero-point energy, you've got energy forever. And that's the potential difference between no force, absolutely no force, and all the force in the universe. Now, you can imagine what a big number that is, Doug.
So that's what's generating their whole power source is they're tapping into zero-point energy.
You bet. It may well be that, and I think this zero-point energy business might be the norm of a huge, huge civilization.
If you were technologically sophisticated enough, it would certainly seem to be a pretty good power source to transport to the galaxy.
Yes.
All right, Nigel.
I'm sorry to labor the point, if I may say so. I mean, it's a very difficult thing to act. My book says, you know, the Greys and the harvesting of souls. It was an actual, wasn't a choice, title choice. It was the choice of my publishers for marketing reasons. But I have to say, in trying, on the face of it, when you look at a thing like that, you think, oh, good God, how on earth is this? So bizarre. It's really ridiculous. And I'm the first to admit that.
Well, the concept is challenging to a lot of people, but sold isn't. You know, I mean, if nothing else, it may, you know, get people to turn pages and, you know, just some.
It's very nice of you to put it that way, but I was totally gobsmacked when I first.
I can imagine because it kind of subverts, you know, what you guys are really working on.
Yeah, but as you say, and I'm very impressed by your erudition here, it does make you think that the connections are so complete when you, as I say, concatenately connect the dots up, you know, that you find that everything is related. And I don't want to talk religion, let me tell you, but I tell you what, I've been recently to Frascati in Italy and sat in at the symposium of all the great minds investigating the phenomenon that has appeared on this piece of cloth. And Andrew actually delivered a talk there. And I tell you, this is the most sensational affirmation of what we as human beings are capable of when you really look at the kind of postulations that serious scientists are making to account for this incredible phenomenon that we call the Shroud of Turin.
All right, and Angel, what in the world does the Shroud of Turin has to do with alien phenomena? Here. You're free. Go for it.
Thank you very much. Interestingly, if I could just bridge this in on what you were saying about talking about the mind and our existence as metaphysics. In fact, if you look at what advances that were made, as I was saying, about nearly 100 years ago in quantum theory, it actually suggests more, rather than that mind being metaphysics, actually physics is meta-mind, that actually the consciousness, the observer, needs to be there even to make matter itself real. Now, an anecdote that I used in my talk on the Shroud of Turin, talking about the connection between mind and matter, was a talk I went to when I was a student around 20 years ago, when the first British professor of parapsychology gave his inaugural lecture on parapsychology, and he was talking about the evidence for and against the existence of what they call PSI, PSI, you know, mind over matter, extrasensory perception. He put forward various different evidence that had been found that people could influence matter and know about things that they couldn't know about through their senses and so on. At the end of the lecture, there was question time, and I put my hand up, and I said, when the chairman pointed to me, I said, I'd just like to say that in raising my hand, I've proved to myself, at least, the existence of the power of mind over matter. We're all doing it every single moment of every day. Every time we make a choice, our minds are influencing matter. It's your mind that tells your arm to go up, and then the brain obeys that. Now, I'll just make a little quick introduction to the shroud for those who don't know too much about it. It's a piece of cloth which has on imprinted on it the image of a man, front and back, that the cloth could have wrapped as a shroud. Now, people may have heard about this 1988 carbon dating thing. Well, this has been already shown by some wonderful work that was done by some great researchers that showed that it was actually the part that was dated was actually mostly made up of a patch that was sewn in later after the cloth was damaged. Amazing discovery about the shroud was made around the end of the 19th century, 1898, when it was first photographed. And this person who photographed it, Secundo Pia, he nearly fainted when he saw the negative picture of the shroud, that the negative picture of the shroud is a perfect positive, because the shroud image itself is a photographic negative. Now, when you study it, you find that it's not painted on, that it's actually a molecular change in the surface fibers of the cloth with distance-coded holographic information. The only photograph of its kind like that in the world. We can't duplicate it with 21st century technology. It shows many characteristics in it that have been shown to be realistic by many forensic pathologists who have studied the cloth in great detail, and show that it was the image of a man who had been tortured and whipped and crucified, and had some kind of sharp implement that was placed on his head that had been bleeding from there. Now, there's so much that ties this into the historical person of Yeshua Ben Yosef, who people know in the English-speaking countries as Jesus. But the fascinating thing to me, and what I gave my talk about, was some speculations about what could have caused that image to have got on there. Now, some much more learned scientists than myself, who have done lots of empirical research on this, have found that you can find similar changes in molecular structure of cloth by a short intense burst of radiant energy. And to have the distance-coded information on there, that radiant energy had to come from the body of the man. In fact, the body of the man, this dead body, was actually shining brighter than the sun for a tiny fraction of a second to have formed that image. This dead body did that. And also, when that was done, it was shown by some other research that was presented at the conference, he was actually vertical and probably suspended in the air, which sounds like a bizarre thing to say, but you can actually find evidence from the position of the feet, the position of the hair and so on when the image was formed that was the case. So what it's suggesting is that this dead body somehow rose up and became vertical and then shone brighter than the sun for a tiny fraction of a second. Now, at the start of my little preamble there, I was saying about the connection between mind and matter. Now, as I say, quantum theory suggests that mind is preeminent in that, and that matter only exists because of the mind. It also suggests, according to Schrödinger, who's one of the greatest proponents of quantum theory, that the mind has no beginning and no end, And also, he also made the point that this concept we have of awareness, sentient, and choice is actually the same in all sentient beings, in all of us. All that's different is our own particular experience, particular memories, and the choices we make. So if it follows that we had no beginning, but the universe had a beginning, then we must trace our existence right back, as Nigel says, to that point and beyond it, although how we define beyond it, we don't have words for that. Now, what that means is that fundamentally, we are all one. Ultimately, once we take off the limits and the restrictions that we've put on ourselves, and that perhaps Stephen Hawking was in a way right when he said that, you know, you don't need God to light the blue touch paper to start the universe, that it wasn't an anthropomorphic creator God doing it and throwing us all in at the deep end, so to speak, that maybe we did it to ourselves, that we have actually taken on limit, and in doing so, we've become separate. Once you become separate, you have to have separation of points, which is space, time, and matter all begin. So universes perhaps happen in that way. And perhaps the great teachers like Yeshua, like Gautama, Buddha, and so on, all that they were actually teaching was actually perfect rational common sense, that it makes sense if you want to continue your existence, then rather than continuing to fly headlong in, along with the second law of thermodynamics that breaks everything apart, that limits you, that divides you through racism, wars, nationalism, selfishness, and so on, that you actually see the way of reversing that, as they did. When they say love your neighbor as yourself, then actually the point is that your neighbor is yourself, that actually if we're fundamentally all one, if you realize that and you live according to that axiom, then maybe physical changes happen as a result of that. And there are many examples, if you look through history of...
Well, the thing that's the most telling about it is the fact that if you look at across every different type of culture and every type of different type of human, okay, genetically, there's the difference between us, regardless of our exterior appearance, is doesn't make any difference.
Yeah, genetically, there's far
genetically,
more difference.
We're all brothers and sisters. I mean, there's not a question about
genetically,
it.
Genetically, the idea of race just falls apart because there's far more difference between two Africans than there would be between, say, an African and a European, for example. That actually our idea of race is just a nonsense in many ways. In fact, we're all
Africans. Absolutely, absolutely. But my question is that, and I mean this with all due respect, mainstream science, I've heard that when they came and did the original research in the late 1980s, I've heard the theory that they didn't get part of the shroud. But if that's the case, I would think that there's reputable scientists that would come back and
they have
it tested all over again.
Well, and, that depends on the church.
I guess my problem where I have difficulty is I'm not refuting what you folks, or I mean what you might be saying happened, okay? This miraculous
at the conference,
body with a gifted human being or you know, a Christ-like being, you know, at the time of their death or their transcendence, you know, there was this process that went on.
Well, I think the point he was making is that all humanity is capable of that. It wasn't that just him. He always thought that.
That's right. What he was trying to say. The wonderful thing I think that this teacher was trying to tell us was if we thought in modes that unite, bring things together against the actual physical laws of the universe, like the second law of thermodynamics, which does the opposite. If we do that, we can actually dissolve the atomic bonds that make us enforced and force-filled, and you get to a certain point that he proved he could get to by the little, you know, kind of insert in the Bible that says he went up to a high place. And in the presence of Peter, James, and John, he stretched his arms out, and he glowed brighter than the sun. I think that this is about the transfiguration of man. And that means you and I out of our own aegis, not by some appoint of law.
What I would certainly like to see, and once again, I mean you no disrespect, is, you know, in order to get this whole thing resolved,
yes,
we test. And
well,
I think that if there was if we can say that the whole test was unreliable on the basis that, because it was my understanding, wasn't originally that the Vatican or whoever was the holder of the shroud were the people that cut the samples.
Yes. Well, that's true.
And they were given, nobody really knew where their sample was from, correct?
Absolutely. Okay. And
the, no, so no.
It's
the point about it is,
I know that there was a fire, and I know that the shroud, that the nuns sewed the shroud back together, but how do we account for the fact that there's no mentioning of the shroud in either the New Testament, and it
there
really doesn't come on the scene historically until the 13th century?
No, there's plenty of evidence. If you read even Ian Wilson's book about
really,
the Mandylion,
Doug and Grant, if you really do read the research, you'll find there's absolutely immense bits of information saying this. And it's only, you know, if you come at this in some kind of way that you don't look at all the kind of literature, you find, I don't blame you for thinking this, but most people would actually come to that conclusion. However, you know, when you look at the literature that's available, and so I'll just give you an interesting thing, if I may, the implication that, you know, from a scientific perspective, believers in the kind of authenticity of the shroud are sadly deluded is actually contradicted by the viewpoint of Professor Christopher Ramsay, for instance, of the University of Oxford and head of the Oxford Radiological Accelerator Unit, which actually participated in the, you know, the original 1988 carbon 14 dating thing of the shroud. And in May 2008, he said this: there's a lot of other evidence that suggests to many that the shroud is older than the radiocarbon dates allow, and so further research is certainly needed. Only by doing this will people be able to arrive at a coherent history of the shroud, which takes into account and explains all the available scientific and historical information. Now, the evidence
to
which Professor Ramsay was referring
is we've got a conflict between somebody who on either side, a bias on the scientific side, on both sides of this whole question whether the shroud is.
You see, this piece of cloth is of immense significance, because if it is proved to be what I now believe it to be, that this is an artifact actually proving to all mankind that we can in fact dispose ourselves into an eternal scale of existence by a particular set of behavioral norms, exercising and using mind, as Andrew said. If this is the case, then we all have a huge amount of hope to a wondrous, wondrous mechanism that is there.
So
or else the alternative would be the opposite, the grays. An institutional paradigm of synthesis based upon synthetic expression that might, in fact, in the end, allow the second law of thermodynamics and the natural way the universe is constructed and enforced to take us all out to a nothingness. And I believe that whilst we have any hope, it is actually in a proposition that came through a man, and I think this guy, Jesus Christ, you know, was a bloke who came here to say to us, if I may put it that way, with respect, I know people believe in him as the Son of God and all the rest of it, but I have to say I've looked at him strictly as a human entity and trying to tell us something different.
Mm-hmm.
There's a very interesting thing, and if I may just take you on this, it's quite an interesting thing because it relates to the grays. There is a portion that says, of this man in the Bible, that says he was taken up to a high place and he was shown the cities of the world. Now, there's only one place you can see the cities of the world, and that is from outer space. Then he was returned down, and some entity was supposed to have said to him, "Fall down and worship me, and I will give you all the earth, everything." So there was an implication that whoever said this actually already owned, if you like, had some custody over the entire earth itself. And this man, Christ, was supposed to have said to this guy, "Get thee behind me, Satan, for it is written, you shall not..." whatever the words were, you know, "thou shalt not tempt the Son of Man," or whatever. And that was putting this particular individual in his place. I think Christ came to actually warn us about the phenomenon that was going to come upon us of these graves that had already befallen man, and that something had to be done to free us all up by giving us this information that we as human beings were in the custody of something that was going to take us all out. And that would indeed be a very, very interesting story, if true.
Such as the graves?
Yeah, such as the graves. I think he came. I think the entire episode of Jesus Christ was, in fact, a warning. He came here to warn us of the principle of synthetic life such as the graves, and that we were in the possession of something terrible like this as a family of being we call a Homo sapiens sapiens, human beings, you know, as such. So, you know, in 2006, for instance, a translation of the recently discovered Gospel of Judas, they say, if you read all the notations, it's really interesting, you know, Doug. There's an awful lot here that the kind of, you know, conventional Christian thesis doesn't broadcast, for obvious reasons, because it takes away the power of the Roman Church, the Vatican, and the priests, and all the rest of that. You know, they lived a nice life and all lived to their 60s and 70s, where all the farmers and everyone was dying at 35 till 1850 or whatever. You take away that authority, and a certain cartel of humanity loses its privileges.
Mm-hmm.
They give us a Lord of the Manor type of God here that is that takes out children and whole tribes and so forth, you know, at a whim. What kind of loving God is that? And yet a Jesus Christ comes and says, turn the other cheek and love thy neighbor as thyself. You've got contradictions all between the Old Testament and the New Testament. And so we're all confused.
Preach it,
so
brother.
I was looking for a way through all of this nonsense to try rationally and logically to see how we get past this, you know? And basically, when you really do the research and go and have a look yourselves, and I don't necessarily tell you that it's going to come from my book, it's just my attempt to put some things before people and say, look, what do you think? You guys out there, it's your soul.
Well, you know, the sad part about it is that if somebody turned up on the streets of Los Angeles or London tomorrow and said that they had all the characteristics of Christ, okay,
yes.
We'd probably go ahead and kill him again.
You're absolutely
unfortunately,
right. I don't think
probably, enough. You know, either kill him or institutionalize him, and we'd all go on our merry way. So, mm-hmm. I mean, as far as an emissary...
I really am impressed. I'm really impressed by your outlook and your erudition, I have to say.
Well, maybe I'm call me a little cynical about humanity sometimes.
I don't think that's cynical. I think there's wisdom there, if I may say so.
Well, that's kind of you. But, you know, I just think that, you know, we forget that lesson. And if an emissary did indeed come, and I have no reason to doubt that there may have been a multitude of emissaries that came to this quarantine place,
yeah.
and you know, and tried to lead us to some
yes.
sort of form of enlightenment, more than one. I believe that there's probably been intergalactic missionaries. You
indeed.
Know, but, you know, maybe that's why they don't come around anymore. Is because
and one of the things that impresses me about this chap, this beautiful Jew, was the fact that the point at which, if you are a con man, the point at which you run is before going into Jerusalem, where you predict you are going to go through a harrowing death. Because all con men would run at that point. He didn't. He went in and had his body mangled. Now, I tell you what, I'm more inclined to believe a guy like that. I don't know about you.
Well, from the standpoint of a sheer humanitarian that showed us that violence is not the way.
You bet.
That was the ultimate act of courage.
Absolutely. Well, the message is certainly good. So we're coming down now in the last few minutes of our program. It's going fast. And we've been talking about gray aliens, the agenda, and numerous other things. So... Let's start summing some things up. First of all, okay, after discussing the Shroud of Turin, what does that have to do, again, in a nutshell, in a very brief nutshell, with the gray aliens, yes. the gray agenda? And you know, we haven't heard from John Biggerstaff much.
Yeah. Okay, John.
Yeah, well, the Shroud of Turin, really, as these other two guys were saying, is a demonstration or is a potential demonstration of what really a human being can do to really overcome what the greys are trying to do to us. And really what it's saying is that really it's innate in us to be able to overcome these apparent genetic controls which are really psychological trends rather than master controls, if you like, because we still have free will and the awareness to understand what's around us, we can actually change our minds and actually then return to this place which is not accessible by these greys, because they're atomic in nature. They can only work within atomic frameworks and forces, and those forces, by really definition, are limited to the atomic frame, so that the space, if you like, the space between these atoms, in a way, in which you have these zero points where all forces cancel out, this is where the consciousness actually lies. And really, so what Nigel's book has really done is start with the problem of the greys, and really what he's had to do is go and identify who we are as human beings in the context of what they're trying to do to us, and then to explain what they're doing to us, and then really using potential evidence evidence such as the Shroud of Turin, really to say that we may be much bigger than that.
Okay,
and one
cool.
of my prime interests, sort of on the side of this, which I'm actually going to discuss a little bit in Nigel's next book, is really how a human body is actually able to achieve that. And I think it's got to do with, again, what I was talking about earlier, to do with these quantum fields, but it's to do with symmetry and removing tensions within the system, not just physically, but obviously one's psychological profile overcomes those tensions in that reverse direction. So we can actually influence the way in which we use either energy or this effective quantum field, this light, if you like, to put it a different way. And so we're still left with the choice as to whether we can actually overcome this. So all is not lost that the greys are necessarily here. It's that we can actually get back out of it, but it requires one to change one's mind and become more expansive in one's view, really.
Okay, so that brings up another question that I had. It was actually from your list of questions, but it's a good question. Okay, so those who are experiencing abduction phenomena, what can they do to get it to stop?
I think the most important thing to identify about these people is that they are special. I think the whole point about these abductees is that if you're an abductee, you shouldn't despair. I believe that abductees are amongst those whom the greys are having problems introducing their programs into. They have they have actually intercepted some biological lines, but there are some individuals that they can't do this to. And I think if they're looking at the Earth as a quantum place where they can play without, you know, with their rules, so to speak, then I think they're discovering the problems, and that's why they abduct specific people. They don't need to bother about the ones that they can get to. It's only the ones they can't get to. So the abductees have a certain ingredient about them, some mysterious factor that makes them rather special. And I think the best way that the abductees can cope with this is to think positively that, no, you will not have my soul or whatever mind aegis you can bring to bear. And I tell you what, there is no way a grey can in any way affect their property and their future and their eternal scale of probability and potential.
Well,
and
so
it's a very I have a very positive feeling for abductees, that they are special and they should stick intransigently to the fact that they are special.
I am glad to hear you say that, because it kind of confirms one of my hypotheses. Is that basically you take your power back, and that is just a nutshell for rectifying all kinds of problems in life.
You bet.
Respect your boundaries, enforce your boundaries, and on and on. We are running out of time here. I did extend it a little bit, but I'm not sure it's taken. Just so we don't run out, but we're getting real close here. So. We have been talking about the Grey Alien Agenda. I want to thank Nigel Kerner, Dr. Andrew Silverman, Professor John Biggerstaff. Thanks so much for coming on the show tonight. It's been interesting.
Thank you for your indulgence.
Thanks for the interesting and wonderful perspective, gentlemen. It was very enlightening tonight.